Featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel, and at the controls is Jason Croft. In this hour of the show, we will take up again a subject that we've discussed quite a bit over the years on the show. That is the politics of the Middle East and very specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It is something where people have very, very dramatically different perspectives. On the show in the past, we have tried, imperfectly perhaps, but we have tried to represent the various perspectives. And we have gotten some critical feedback about some of the recent programs that we have done on the subject from people who feel that we are not representing the Palestinian perspective very well, or at least the programs that we've done have tended to lean in the direction of the Israeli side of things. And so we are trying to do some more programming and trying to address that kind of criticism. And this morning's program is in part intended to do that. We will be talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Allison Weir. She is a journalist, freelance journalist. She's also the founder of an organization called If Americans Knew. It is an independent, non-for-profit research and information dissemination institute. Their particular focus and interest, area of interest, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as well as U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, and also the way the media covers those issues. She was suggested to us as a guest, and we thought that we would go ahead and take up that suggestion. Also, she is going to be here, I believe, next week in our area in Champaign-Urbana, and we'll get the information on her appearance, and we can give it to you a little bit later on. Questions and comments, of course, are welcome. We only ask that people are brief. And we ask that so that we can keep the program going, moving along, and getting as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is interested in calling in and being part of the conversation is welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere. You can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. It's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ms. Weir, hello.
Hello.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Perhaps I should ask you at the beginning to talk a little bit more about this organization that you started, If Americans Knew.
Great.
And how it is that you, its focus, and how it is that you came to start it.
Excellent. I'd love to talk about that. And I can go on and on, so feel free to cut me off
okay. If
necessary. My background is in journalism, and that's my perspective, is just get the information to people as accurately and fully as we can without bias or distortion. That's the job of journalism, and I'm so glad to hear that your station is attempting to do that, too. What brought me to this particular issue is sort of unusual. I'm the typical American who never paid attention to Israel and Palestine before. I happen to come from an ethnically Christian background. I'm not Jewish or Middle Eastern or Muslim, and I had never paid attention really very much to this particular issue of Israel and Palestine. What brought me to it is about 4 years ago when the current uprising began, and I just became curious about what this issue was about. At that time, I was the editor of a newspaper in Sausalito, California, so it certainly was not part of my beat. I didn't cover foreign affairs for that newspaper at all. But just by becoming curious about the issue, I began to look into it just independently. As I did that, I felt very clearly that I was, from the American media, I was largely getting the pro-Israel perspective and a great deal of detail about Israel, about its perspective, about what was happening there. And that was valuable. I welcomed that information and still do. But it seemed to me that I was not getting equivalent information about the Palestinian aspect of the conflict. So when I looked into that more, I was so astounded and shocked and somewhat outraged at what I was finding by going to international media. And seeing that that was not being presented in my normal sources of information, the New York Times, NPR, etc., that after a few months of looking into this issue, I was so drawn to its importance and to the misinformation I felt, sadly, was being given to the American public, that I decided as a journalist I needed to just go and see for myself what the reality was there. So I quit my job at that time, bought a round-trip ticket, went to spend a month traveling independently as a freelance journalist throughout the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and just seeing for myself without any sort of sponsorship or guidance, traveling spontaneously without pre-planning. I wanted to be able to just see things completely independently. And what I saw was so different than what is still really, for the most part, being portrayed in the American media. And it is so important that Americans know the facts about this issue, that when I returned, it seemed very clear to me I needed to do something more. And at that point, I decided to start If Americans Knew.
Let me ask you to pick up just on one point there, because it's sort of my perception, at least from what you hear from people who would identify themselves as supporters of Israel, the criticism that the American media is either anti-Israeli or pro-Palestinian or both. Now, you're saying from your perspective, your judgment, that that's not the case.
It's again, thank you. This is an important question. I have the good fortune on this particular issue to not come with a particular bias towards either side. You know, I'm sure there are other issues I would have to overcome that, but in this case, I don't have that background. I've looked into this. If people go to our website, they can see the media studies that we've done on this issue. We've done very clear, simple statistical studies so that you can just count up our numbers. It's similar to a scientific study where we're either accurate with our numbers or we're not. It's not a matter of interpretation or if someone has a particular bias towards one population or the other. And people should ask for this. You know, if anyone ever alleges bias or distortion, we should be required to document whether or not that's the case. So we decided to look into it and document whatever we found we would put out there. And our statistical analyses were really shocking even to us. It was far worse than we even had expected we would find. For example, if I could just give you a few quick results of what I'm afraid are just typical newspapers. We found that the San Francisco Chronicle, for example, we looked at the first 6 months of its coverage of the current uprising, since first impressions are extremely powerful, and they give us the impression of who is the aggressor, who initiated the violence, who is therefore responding and retaliating, etc. It's an important period. And we looked at the coverage of deaths of both populations in headlines. To us, the human beings on both sides are equally important, their deaths equally tragic. We found that, for instance, in the subcategory of children's deaths, a particularly sad aspect of this conflict, we found that the Chronicle had given headline coverage to 150% of Israeli children who had so tragically been killed during that period, 150%. And we found that they had covered only 5% of the Palestinian children who had also so tragically been killed during that six-month period. What we found, and this we're finding is consistently the case, that Israeli deaths not only were covered prominently almost every single time, but often a single death would generate more than one headline story. That's the reason that they were able to report on over 100% of Israeli children's deaths, because several deaths were covered several times, whereas for the Palestinian population, to meet an equally valuable, you know, human population, we found that in 95% of the cases, they weren't even presented once. That's a 30-to-1 differential. To me, one group of human beings is not 30 times more important than another group of human beings.
What about, I'm thinking of the accusation that the American media devotes more attention to violence perpetrated by Israelis on Palestinians, more attention than they do, say, suicide bombings. What if you look at something like that look at that coverage? What do you find?
Well, to me, it's just startling that people can even make such an accusation, because it is so much the reverse. It's just astounding that it's so blatantly the opposite. For example, let's look at we'll look at another newspaper. This is the San Jose Mercury News. It's in Silicon Valley. And again, we didn't choose it because we thought it would be better or worse than any others. It was just nearby, and we were curious about it. We found, for example, in front page headlines. And remember, you know, we're all leading busy lives. There are many issues to look into. We're trying to just raise our families, pay our bills, etc. On foreign topics in particular, many of us skim the headlines, you know, typically on a subject like this, especially in the early days. So we looked at front page headlines, and we found that the Mercury News had covered in front page headlines 70% of the Israelis who had been killed by Palestinians during that period. 70% of their deaths made front page headlines. In other words, this is covering quite well with this is front page headline coverage. Remember, there's additional coverage inside the paper. So this is headline coverage that was giving information about Palestinian violence, about Israelis. Now let's look at the reverse and see if we also got 70% coverage of Israeli violence against Palestinians, which I would have hoped would be the case. You should have about equivalent coverage of both populations, especially this was over a six-month period. So this is, you know, a very long time frame for a study. We found, no, that's not what they had done. They had not given us 70% coverage of Israeli violence. They hadn't even given us 60 or 50% or 45% or 30%. They had given us 5% coverage of the Israeli violence that had been committed against the Palestinian population during that period. So again, we're seeing 70% coverage of Israeli victims, and we are seeing 5% coverage of Palestinian victims. We didn't create these numbers. These are the numbers that are there. They're on our website with a complete spreadsheet. People, you know, very validly should ask us to prove these. We have done that. A Stanford professor looked into our numbers and has now validated our study.
I have a caller. I want to bring them into the conversation. I also want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Allison Weir. She is a journalist, has been a journalist off and on for many years. As a freelancer, she went on an independent investigation to the West Bank and Gaza. Since that time, she has done a lot of speaking about what she's seen on Capitol Hill, to various Washington, D.C. think tanks at many different universities. And she's also the founder of this organization we've talked about that's called If Americans Knew. And they do indeed have a website. If you're interested and you have internet access, you can go to the website. It is www.ifamericansknew, and that's all as one word, so no spaces in between the letters, ifamericansknew.org. We have a caller here to talk with, and we'll start off with them, and that is Champagne in line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I had a question about how do the Palestinians react when Palestinian militants blow up a bus and they murder everybody on the bus, and there's Jews on there, and then there's Palestinians on there. Like, are those people just considered martyrs for the cause? Or, like, when you do a random act like that, you end up killing, you know, whoever happens to be in the area. You have no control over who that is. So ultimately, they must kill some Palestinians, right?
Yeah, I'd be happy to respond to that. They are as horrified as we are. You know, when you look into the killing of civilians on both sides of this issue, it is I am quite clear that both populations are against that. Now, sadly, it's the Israeli forces that have killed many more civilians than Palestinians have. I'll try to get this, if I can look it up quickly, give you the exact numbers. But about five times, as I recall, five times more Palestinian civilians have been killed in the last 4 years than Israeli civilians. So again, the caller is asking the question, posing it toward only one population. And it's not surprising because these are the headlines, as I've just proven to you, that you're reading. A really more accurate question would be to pose the question, how do both populations view the fact that representatives of their populations are killing civilians? And both populations, I'm hoping, are... I was in the Palestinian territories. I found people were very saddened and horrified whenever Israeli civilians were killed.
But that wasn't my question. When Palestinians kill Palestinians, how do Palestinians react?
They react, I'd say, with as great sadness as when they kill Israeli civilians. They're saddened by both of those.
Okay, how about this question? Do you think that people react differently to random violence versus something that one side can consider or both sides consider a war? Like, I think people get very upset if you get mugged on the street in Champaign, but if a soldier dies in Afghanistan, it's not such a shock.
Yeah, let me...
Random violence really upsets us. I mean, as humans, as a group.
Yeah. Well, let's get into that more. Again, these are very good questions. The just to bring, go back to the bus example a little bit and then to answer this, you know, your follow-up question. The one thing that I think a lot of people do not understand, and again, our media should be making this clear, that's the job of journalists, is that when you ride a bus in Israel, in particular certain parts of Israel, and most of the people on that bus are soldiers. I rode a bus where, you know, I got on and almost no one was on it. By the time I'd gotten to my destination, every other person, literally, every single, and this was a very crowded bus by the end of my trip, every single person was in uniform and was a soldier. So, you know, sometimes it certainly is clear that some of these buses are, in a sense, military targets. They are the way that Israel often transports its soldiers. Now, in terms of, as you say, what is the difference between killing in war and killing not in war? This is a war that's going on over there. When I was in Gaza and visiting some of those residential neighborhoods, I found places that looked just like the pictures I've seen of World War II ruins. You know, bullet-riddled buildings, destroyed buildings, family homes just in ruins, although sometimes people were still living in those homes because they had nowhere else to go. And it occurred to me as I was walking around that I was in a war zone. You know, I mean, this is what war zones look like. But this was a war zone with only one side having an army, the Israeli side. So in other words, this is a war, and the Israeli side has a very strong military. In fact, most people rate it as the fourth or at least the fifth strongest military on earth, far stronger than all of the other militaries in that region combined. They have F-16s, they have nuclear weapons, they have Apache helicopters, all provided by U.S. taxpayers' money. And on the other side, in this war, you find a population largely without weaponry of any kind. There are some rifles, there are homemade mortars. There is, however, no way to deliver a bomb on that side of this war.
I agree. I think those buses probably are now probably legitimate targets. The thing that I wonder about, though, is, you know, they may not have all the guns that the Israelis have, but they have all kind of funding from other places, like Saudi Arabia spends a lot of money keeping those militant organizations going, so the war will never stop.
Well,
like if you look at the area, we always hear about these refugee camps.
Mm-hmm.
Why are there still refugee camps? I mean, World War II, a greater war than this by many means, millions more people displaced. Why, you know, 40 years after...
A very excellent question, both of those.
Camps.
If I could, let me take... It's always easier for me to do a few at a time, and then you can go on with others. So let's talk about these refugee camps and why there still are refugees. That's an excellent, very, very central question. The reason there are still refugees is because Israel, against international law, against UN resolutions that it agreed to, has refused to allow refugees to return to their homes. This is very central to this conflict. As you noted, every other refugee on earth has the right to return to their homes. This is the case with World War II refugees. This is the case with refugees from every other conflict. When the war is over, the farmers go back to their farms, the villagers go back to their villages, etc. This is a recognized right that all human beings have. However, Israel is refusing to allow those refugees to return, and therefore they are still refugees. In fact, some of them, this is part of the bizarre nature of this conflict that, you know, by now I've spent 4 years doing nothing but study this issue and reading dozens of books on the history. And there are such strange things going on in Israel itself. For example, from the war that created Israel, the 1948 war, which is called the
war. It was an edict from the UN. It wasn't a war.
No, it wasn't. It was a recommendation. The caller's referring to the 1947 recommendation for a partition plan. This is not an edict. There was a war that had actually come out of that, but it was already a continuing war. A war between the Zionists who wanted a Jewish state and the Palestinians who wanted to hold their own land. From that war, we have displaced approximately 800,000 people. It's hard to know the exact numbers. The UN counted them at the time, and other groups did too, so it's somewhere around 700,000 up to 850,000, somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the entire indigenous population at that time was forced to flee their homes. Some of these people, however, most of them ended up in surrounding countries or in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Some of these refugees, however, remained within what is now Israel. However, they would just go to the next village over, whatever, you know, just trying to run away. Most people in wars are not warriors. They just want to protect their families, and that was true of the Palestinian population as well. So they would go to the next village over. Then at the end of the war, when they tried to go back to their homes, they were not allowed to. They were designated present absentees. So Israel, it's really Kafkaesque to try to describe what Israel has done for the past 50-some years. Because what happened is that the refugees that fled their homes, their property was immediately given to Jewish settlers. And that was designated absentee property. So something like 10,000 people, for example, moved into fully furnished homes in Jerusalem. The people who had inhabited those homes were just a little ways away living and many of them dying in tents because of the harsh conditions. But quite a few of them were in Israel itself. They were nearby. They wanted to return to their homes, but they were designated present absentees, I think, is the specific legal, if you can call this legal, definition, and have not been allowed to go to their own homes, even though, you know, they're refugees within what is supposedly their own country.
I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me. The lines are full. We are already at our midpoint, and I want to give some other people a chance to get in here with their questions. But let me, Ms. Weir, let me ask you one, and it's an issue that is embedded in the very thing that you and the caller started talking about, and that's this. We have here the two sides in this conflict both applying violence as a means to get what they want. We have Palestinian suicide bombers, and then we have retaliation against those acts by Israel with Israel's military. And
Actually, let me correct you. I do think it's so important to get our wording correct.
All right.
So the retaliation is actually the reverse. If you look at the chronology of this, you find that it was the Palestinians who died in far greater numbers first. 140, and this is a lot of human beings, were killed by Israeli forces before there was any hint of a suicide bombing. So we find that the suicide bombings, which of course are extremely tragic, I can't think of a more tragic kind of phenomenon. But let's get our terminology correct. These are retaliations against Israeli actions that have already killed many Palestinian children and innocent civilians. I think civilians are innocent on both sides. So we find that, for example, 84 Palestinian children were killed before a single Israeli child was killed. So just to, you know, correct your phraseology, the suicide bombings are the retaliation, not the Israeli actions.
All right. Well, the thing that I'm going for is that some people would make the argument that, as you have, and if I'm putting words in your mouth, you do correct me because I don't want to do that, have made the argument that what we have here is a war, And at least at this point, what we have is two sides using whatever tools they have at their disposal. Now, the Israelis object very strongly to using that kind of language to describe it because they say it creates a moral equivalence between the actions of the Palestinian suicide bomber and the actions of the Israeli soldier, as if to suggest that somehow one, because it's the country's military, mm-hmm. and they call this self-defense, is legitimate, but the other is the act of a terrorist. And I wonder how you look at this very issue. Are these two things, in your mind, what the suicide bomber does, what the Israeli soldier does, are they essentially the same?
I think that the killing of civilians, no matter who does it, is the same. So, you know, that's the answer to that question. When the Israeli military kills civilians, which it has done, according to many estimates, in 80... So, again, you know, it's hard to determine this, but the numbers are at least 60% of the Palestinians that Israeli soldiers have killed are civilians. And it is quite likely that 85% of all of the Palestinian deaths that have been done by Israeli soldiers have been civilians. We have 2,000, this is through August 20th. I looked up these numbers a few months ago. So August 20th, 2,428 Palestinian civilians were killed by Israeli soldiers. How many Israeli civilians were killed? These, you know, we always gather numbers for both populations. 538 Israeli civilians were killed. So to me, killing civilians, killing children is immoral, and it's equally immoral no matter who does it and no matter what means they happen to use to deliver their killing bombs or their killing weapons.
Well, I know some people, and forgive me, this is not intended to be a hostile question, but I think that people will hear what you have to say and will hear you saying that somehow guilt is proportional, and that is somehow that the Israelis are worse because they've killed more Palestinians than Palestinians have killed Israelis.
I think that the point I would want to make, and I would certainly hope most people agree with this, is that the killing of one civilian is a tragedy. The killing of 10 is a tragedy. The killing of 1,000 is a tragedy. And there are civilians dying on both sides of this. Now, when we want to get out of a conflict, when we want to bring peace, we need, however, to know more than that. We need to know which civilians died first, who's initiating the violence, and who's retaliating, because clearly the people with greater, the population in any issue, this, I'm just applying the common sense to this one, we do apply everywhere else, we find that the side that initiates the violence and that has the power, the greater power in the dispute, is the side that also has the power to end its initiating actions, and therefore that will end the retaliations as well. And when you look into this, you find that it is the Israeli military that has that power. It initiated the actions. It kills and killed and will continue unless the world brings peace to this region, far more civilians among the Palestinian population than the reverse.
Let me once again introduce the guest, and we'll get right back to the calls. We're talking with Allison Weir. She's a journalist, has been a journalist off and on for many years. As a freelancer, she went on an independent investigation to the West Bank and Gaza a couple of years ago. Since then, has been talking about it in a variety of venues, including a lot of universities. She's also the founder of an organization called If Americans Knew, which is, as it says on its website, a not-for-profit research and information dissemination institute, particularly interested in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, media coverage of the issue, and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. She will be here in Champaign-Urbana giving a talk next week on Tuesday at noon. This will be happening at the Channing Murray Foundation, sponsored by the local organization AWARE, and is free and open to the public, so anybody who is interested should certainly feel welcome to stop by. We'll go back to the telephones here and get on to our next caller, and this would be a caller in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Yeah, really enjoy listening to your guest. I think she's right on target, especially when she brings up the way the media is so biased in its coverage of things like children who are killed. It's it's so obvious if you just do a little bit of digging, and yet, you know, it just goes on and on and on. It's unbelievable. To me, Israel is kind of the proving ground for tactics we want to use in our own behalf, like state-sponsored murder. So referring to your website, the title of it, If Americans Knew, my first reaction is really dubious. What evidence do you have that Americans are moved by your statistics, and maybe even more relevant, what is the reaction of the media itself to the statistics you've been able to come up with as to the coverage?
Yeah. Well, thank you for those questions. Fortunately, what I'm finding about Americans, as I am having the opportunity in the past few years to speak around the country to really a great variety of audiences, and I find, without exception, audiences are extremely moved when they learn these facts. Truly, it's not an ideological or a political response. I find audiences of conservative background or leftist or progressive background all truly equally moved when they learn the facts of what's going on in Israel and Palestine and the horrible devastation. When people learn what it's like and see the photographs, you know, the largest single cause of death, by the way, for these Palestinian children. And I urge anybody to check these figures. You can look on our website and others to get the actual numbers. And you find the single largest single cause of death of Palestinian children, this is so, you know, hard to even say this, is gunfire to the head. This is what's going on. When people find out the facts of what's happening, they are horrified, and the question always is, what can we do about this? So I think, you know, I titled the organization If Americans Knew, because the majority of our population, as the majority of other populations around the world, consists of decent people who will try to live a moral and practical life and are horrified when they see, you know, huge tragedy, especially when they learn that it's our tax money that's paying for such tragedy. Now, in terms of how the media react when we do our studies, there's a sort of a continuum there. There's not just one type of response. We find that in some cases there is extreme defensiveness, and they will not even meet with us. That's sort of one extreme of what the response that we get. Although individuals in the publication sometimes will be very concerned and will talk with us. At the other end, we find people that also, you know, when you come up with these kind of numbers about a publication, the human nature does show that the people that are being shown to have been so negligent as to have this kind of coverage are at first defensive. However, when we show them our numbers, we prove to them that this is what their newspaper did. In some of these cases, they're not even aware that their pattern was nearly this bad. In some cases, they truly are not aware of how many Palestinians had been killed during that period. They're just taking their wire service reports and sort of emulating the New York Times, and they think they're getting it right. So when we show them that they're hugely distorting with the reality of what's going on, and in some cases really presenting it inversely to what the reality is, then we find that once they get beyond their defensiveness, they also are extremely concerned and trying to figure out what they can do about it. And at that point, we find that some publications begin to make a better effort to cover it more fully and more accurately. And when there are wire service reports about Palestinian deaths, which there sometimes are less often, but then they are very careful to make sure that they do print those stories, that they give them sufficient play in their newspapers, etc. So we find that this can make a difference to how the publications cover this issue. More important than taking it to the editors, however, is that we also get this information out to the public. We feel that the readers need to know when they've been misinformed on an issue so that they can then bring sufficient skepticism to future reports when they read their newspapers or watch their television or listen to their radio.
I'm going to have to visit your website. Can I ask somewhat on a different topic? you seem very knowledgeable about the conflict and its source, its history. Can you talk a little bit about the rather large Palestinian minority in Israel and what's going on with them? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. There is, as you say, about somewhere between 17 to 20% of the population of Israel are Palestinians. Now, again, just the terminology is very revealing and quite important. Israel always refers to these as Israeli Arabs. That's a somewhat offensive term. I know when I talk about other groups, I try to use the identification that they prefer, just out of respect to others. And the people in Israel of Palestinian ancestry call themselves Palestinians, not, quote, Israeli Arabs. This is a somewhat generic term, and it's the way that the fact that there is such a thing as a Palestinian population and culture has been denied for many, many years. So that's one of the aspects that it's important to look into. And you find that the Palestinians who have outwardly Israeli citizenship are being treated extremely different when they are Palestinian. And by the way, what this means, a Palestinian is someone who is Christian or Muslim. When you look back at the beginning of the conflict, and to do that you would go back to the 1800s, you find that this land was multicultural. It was made up of 80% Muslims, 15% Christians, and 5% Jewish inhabitants of the land. So now the ones that are left over that are called Palestinians are the people that were originally 95% of that land. They are now living in extremely substandard conditions. They're not getting anywhere near the equivalent social services that their Jewish neighbors get. They, in many cases, there's a high percentage. At one point, it may still be this high. It was 60% of Palestinian neighborhoods were not even getting garbage pickup. Their schools are you know, extremely poor. If you look at the worst disparity in the U.S., and we have, of course, great disparity here between different populations and the way that they're being served by social services, consider that disparity and magnify it by a factor of about two or three, and you get some feeling of how the entire Palestinian population in Israel is living. There are some excellent books on this topic. One of them, written by three Israeli former government officials, and I can't think of the title, but on our website we have a recommended books, and this is one of the books I recommend that people look into.
Right. We have a number of other callers. In fact, the lines are full, and we have about 15 minutes left. So if we don't get everybody in, my apologies. We'll see what we can do. We'll go
and
next.
I should mention that I'm going to be speaking at a number of places in Illinois, Indiana, and I believe Kentucky while I'm in this area.
Mm-hmm.
So my schedule, unfortunately, I can't give you those facts right now, but my schedule should be on our website for anybody that's interested in coming and hearing me and raising any questions that you'd like to raise.
All right, very good. We'll go to the next caller, Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I don't know where to begin, but I'll start at some point. Since your speaker, used the example of Kafkaesque, I'd like to say that her presentation is Kafkaesque and continuously distorted. And the points are numerous. I'll pick a few and can go from there. The first, when she states that the war in 48 was between, as she puts it, Zionists and Palestinians, of course that's a distortion. The war in 48 was between the Jewish population and, to a great extent, the Arab armies of five Arab states. And included in that were what the Palestinian population. But for the most part, it was these five armies which decided to have a war rather than accept the partition that the UN set up. That's point one.
Why don't I answer one point at a time?
What?
I'm suggesting that I could point.
Okay, well, now wait, folks. We can't. If both of you talk at once, we're not going to be able to understand any of you. And if this is the way the caller wants to go, go ahead.
Sure.
But please bear in mind that we do only have 15 minutes, and there are other callers.
Right. I will mention my points, and then I'll get off. since she's going to respond in her, with her distortions, which
I'm just curious about how many points you're going to be bringing up.
Let me bring them up.
Okay.
Second, you justify the bombing because there are soldiers on the bus. Now, most Israelis between the age of 18 and 25 are soldiers. So when you have people who are soldiers either in their for their two-year service or whatever the length of the service is, or for their reserve service, you're essentially including large portions of the Israeli population as soldiers, justifying the suicide bombing of those buses because there are soldiers on those buses. It's fairly outrageous. But anyway, let's go on. When you say there's a war, in part, the reason there's a war is because Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and certain other parties decided to use violence to settle what was a political conflict with political negotiations that had been going on after Oslo. So that's part of the reason we have war. The fact that when you say there's a large number of civilians being killed on the Palestinian side, while that's true, also there are many people called civilians who are active participants in the fighting, whether with stone throwing, using rifles, etc., who aren't civilians, but get classified in that way. I'll make one more point, and then I'll get off, and you can say what you wish. You talk about the refugees. In a way, that's a very complicated situation. And to really look at it, we have to look at all the different research that has come on about the different reasons why people left their homes. Some was because they thought that if they left in 48, the Arab armies would destroy Israel. Some because there was fighting in the neighborhood and they wanted to get away from it. Some because there was Jewish soldiers in their area and they were feeling forced out. There are many reasons. The fact is that after 48, most of the Palestinians in the refugee camps refused to come back at that point.
That's false.
Excuse me, let me say.
I'm hoping I'm going to have sufficient time to answer
you. You'll have sufficient time because you're going to say what you're going to say anyway. Most of them refused to come back at that point. Since then, they only wanted to come back in a Palestinian state, not into an Israeli state. So I'll stop at that point. There's a lot more that can be said, but obviously you are clearly anti-Israeli and willing to distort all sorts of things in order to make your point. I'll stop at that point.
Well, go ahead, Ms. Weir.
Okay, I will. It's always a shame when we get into these personal attacks, but I'm not unused to that kind of situation. The last one, I'm sorry I interrupted, but it was just, I've just not heard that particular theory before, that the Palestinians refuse to return to their homes. There's absolutely no basis for that, so I'm not quite sure where that came from, because it's just absolutely false. The fact that they only will return to a Palestinian state is also absolutely false. The numbers are very clear on this. Nobody's making that argument, so I hope you'll look into that more. Going back then from the beginning, I'll take these points one by one. The first one was about the war of 1948, al-Nakba, the catastrophe, according to Palestinians and others, the war of independence, according to Israel. The caller, I think, somewhat misunderstood what I had said, but I'm happy to clear that up. He is saying that it was a war between Jews and the five Arab armies. Now, let's take both halves of that equation, and I'll show you where he's correct and where he's incorrect. I don't usually use the word Jews because not the original Jewish population in what was originally called Palestine up until 1948 was actually anti-Zionist. That changed with the immigration over many years, but there were many, but the original 5% were actually quite strongly against Zionism, and a number of those people still living in Israel at the time were also against Zionism. So rather than using Jews and incorrectly labeling the forces, it's more accurate to call it a Zionist force, but it could be called both ways. In terms of the other side, it wasn't. I do agree, and I don't think that I said it was only Palestinians on the other side of it. Today it is. That's why that's the correct term to use. When you're talking about Palestinians, use that term. But there were these other Arab armies that also came in. Let's look at the facts, however, of what you find. And again, the caller has done us all a favor by raising myths that many of us grew up believing. You can look into the numbers on this issue and the actual chronology and the events of the War of 1948, and you find that according to U.S. military experts at the time who were studying the coming conflict and then the conflict as it went on, the Zionist forces actually outnumbered the Arab forces that came to fight them. It's really surprising because they were coming from five countries. However, they were sending very small numbers. So according to most of the numbers that you see from the military assessment in the U.S. and military assessment in Britain, there are many more forces under the Zionist armies than under the Arab armies. It's one estimate gave it 90,000 compared to 30,000. Another place gives it about 56,000 versus 25,000. Again, it depends on how you're defining things and what point in the war, et cetera. But that's the reality of that particular war and the two sides of that war. Getting to the bombing of a bus, the second point, I'm not quite sure what, I think he really just validated what I had said. And I think it is important to point out, as the caller did, that most Israelis between 18 and 25 are soldiers. I mean, this is an extremely militarized society. And that's a fact. I certainly agree with the caller that that's correct. On the third point, let me see, this was that there's a war because Hamas and Islamic Jihad used violence, whereas the Israeli forces had not been using violence. Again, that's just not correct. You look at the chronology, and as I already mentioned earlier, the first violence did come from Israeli forces, not from the Palestinian forces. So that's just the chronology of it. I was really surprised to hear the caller saying something, although I shouldn't have been, because you do hear this elsewhere, that stone throwing is the equivalent of a soldier, and they're not, therefore they're not civilians. Well, you know, I don't think that stone. There are demonstrations in Israel, and if the caller has been to Israel, as I suspect he has, he must know this. There are demonstrations in Israel where some of the more fanatic, more conservative Jewish citizens of Israel will protest the government not being religious enough, and they will throw stones. Never have they been treated to live gunfire against them. So I think, you know, people throwing stones does not justify shooting them in the head. It's just not an equivalency to me, but perhaps it is to the caller. Then getting to the final point about refugees and the reasons that they left home. This is one of these myths of the conflict that has now really been put to rest, here I am having to try to put it to rest again. In Israel itself, the fact that these Palestinian refugees were actively forced out by a policy of the Israeli government has been revealed when the Israeli archives were declassified and people had access to what the orders had been, the actions taken by Israeli forces, etc. And it became clear at that point that the Palestinian refugees had been forced out through the military actions of Israel itself. There are a number of historians that have written about this, Israeli historians. Of course, Arab and Palestinian historians had been writing about that for many years. But then these Israeli historians, finding the chance to look at the archives, validated what the others had been writing for many years. One of them is very famous, Benny Morris, has written about this in the past and wrote about it again. And not long ago, he had an op-ed in the L.A. Times where he once again says, yes, they were forced out. There were many massacres. Israel committed, I believe the number is 56 massacres of Palestinian villages during this war. But really astoundingly, Morris at that point in his op-ed just not too long ago in the L.A. Times said that the only problem was that Israel had not done enough, that rather than stopping at the point that it did, It should have committed more massacres. It should have expelled more people and finished its act of ethnic cleansing that it had only partially finished by, in other words, leaving what is now about 20% of the population was wrong, according to Morris. They should have totally ethnically cleansed the land. It's just astounding, the things that you read by some of the supporters of Israel. Now, fortunately, I'm sorry I haven't had the chance to give more information. There are many Israelis that are opposing these actions and that are very outraged at what their government is doing and has been doing for a long time. There are many organizations. There's B'Tselem, Gush Shalom. They have websites that are excellent sources of information. There are many Israeli soldiers, increasing numbers, who are refusing any longer to serve in the forces that are serving the West Bank and Gaza Strip. There are now officers, even generals, that are saying, we refuse any longer to drop bombs on a largely unarmed population. So there is increasing resistance to what the Israeli government is doing inside Israel by Jewish citizens as well.
Well, I'm sorry that I'm going to have to say that we're out of time. We have a number of callers that we can't take, but we've simply exhausted the time. We will have to leave it at that. I do, however, want to mention again one more time that our guest, Allison Weir, is traveling around the Midwest and making a number of appearances, and you can find them on the website. Just to mention a couple, tomorrow she's going to be in Chicago speaking at the Lakeshore campus of Loyola University, Monday at Illinois College in Jacksonville, and then also that same day, it's going to be a big day, she's going to be in St. Louis at Washington University, and then here on Tuesday, she'll be giving a talk at noontime at the Channing Murray Foundation, sponsored by AWARE, and it's free and open to the public. And anybody who is interested is welcome. And then if you would like to find out more about her organization, which is called If Americans Knew, they do have that website, and the site address is pretty easy to handle. It's www.ifamericansknew.org. And Ms. Weir, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part by grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programming is also made possible by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the return of the Mark Morris Dance Group for community engagement and performances with live music April 7th and 8th. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though, because there's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine, and the host, Celeste.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, millions of Americans are hospitalized each year. How prepared are we for the experience? This afternoon, following the 1 o'clock news, we'll talk with a doctor who heads a family practice unit at a New York hospital. Dr. Joseph Sacco is also the author of The Health Smart Hospital Handbook. Get in, get well, go home. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Taking a look now.